Now here we go.
Most people really don't believe me. I know that. I live with that every day of my life. I've been pretty well tuned out by the media. If anything is remembered of me, I guess in the general world, what they remember is, haha, rectal probe, or he's a disturbed man, he's crazy, or something like that. But the truth is, I am not crazy. This is about emotions and feelings more powerful than human beings experience. It's about living and facing such experiences, and it is hard. It is real hard.
Bad things have happened to people from my childhood who I returned to meet again. I think I was traumatized in early childhood, and I don't think I'm alone. I think the whole neighborhood was bruised as if an invisible fist had come.
And also, I want to go home.
I don't think that I did it. I don't know what I did exactly connected with this in terms of intelligence work.
I can't get that face out of my head.
Apparently nothing. I can't remember anything at all. Not even a snatch of anything.
Really?
You will not live if you join the CIA. But I am a very conventional person. I was not able to control what happened. As you undoubtedly aware, there's a whole school of thought in our world that they're evil. And they wouldn't disagree with them for a minute. Dark side and evil are complicated issues. We make the dark side evil by the way we deal with it. And the grays will test you and test you and test you. The more you work with the dark side, the more successful you are, the darker they get. Until you find the only thing is surrender.
Because I cannot do a thing about this. I don't even want to look up at this.
The only thing is surrender.
Can we help you stop screaming? Can we help you stop screaming?
So, what book by Carl Jung?
Modern Man in Search of a Soul.
Oh, yeah. I think I own that book. I don't think I've ever read it, but I've owned it for like 20 years.
Well, we've owned it for quite some time. I don't remember when it came into our possession, but I just plucked it off the shelf today.
And what have you found there?
A lot, actually, already. I mean, I'm on page 40, and one of the things that I've decided to believe is that anyone who wants to research the UFO should start with Jung's flying saucers, and then, which I already felt very strongly about, but then rather than going on to UFO literature, should just go on to read more Jung.
Oh, okay.
I think that it would be more helpful, actually, because it's as though he's talking about it's indirectly, the whole time, really. Maybe not the whole time, but a great deal of the time. It's relevant, it's pertinent, I think.
Yeah. I think I've read Jung's It was more of an essay than a book on flying saucers. Am I right?
It was an essay that was turned into a very short book, yeah.
Right. And, boy, I must have read that 20 years ago. And he thinks the flying saucer is a manifestation of our collective unconscious, and that it... But what did he think it symbolized again?
I think he would say it was more than that it symbolized, but that it was the exteriorized psyche, the psyche as projected outward into some sort of physical form.
Now, Terence McKenna used to talk about that same idea a lot, picking it up from Jung. But he would talk about exteriorizing the soul or the psyche as something that would happen after 2012 or, you know, after the eschaton. But Jung thinks that it was happening in these sightings, that it was already going on, that the psyche was projecting itself in some sort of physical form into the heavens.
Well, he had to allow that it was taking physical form later on, I believe, because of the radar evidence and suggesting, I mean, unequivocally that it had some sort of physical form. Of course, we talk about UFO as an it is, I think, a mistake, even just kind of empirically speaking, because... there are many different kinds of unidentified flying objects, right? Including ones which maybe aren't objects at all and aren't flying, and so on and so forth. Like it's a label that gives a false sense of, consistency to something that is very inconsistent.
Well, yeah. I mean, although it's a UFO. I mean, if you're literal about it, a UFO is an unidentified flying object.
But, I mean, if we start replacing UFO for it, and as if we're always talking about the same thing, then we're already falling into a trap, I think.
Yeah. So how can you differentiate a UFO from a flying saucer, as you talked about it, you know, as a projection of the psyche? What would be the markings of a flying saucer, other than its saucer shape? Or was that one of the key things?
Wait, was that one of the keys for a UFO or
for a flying saucer? Wasn't the flying saucer what he thought was the projection of the psyche, and the UFO could be kind of a mark?
Oh, that's true. The book, though, the essay was called Flying Saucers, so I'm not 100% sure if he used the term UFO or not. It's a significant point from, you know, based on what we're talking about now, but it never seemed that significant previously. But of course, yeah, UFOs take many forms besides the form of a saucer. In fact, my wife found an image which I plan to use at some point of a UFO that looks quite distinctly like a penis and testicles.
Right. I think that would count as a Jungian projection of the psyche. You said that you thought rather than go into, I mean, it's very tempting to go into, if you've read, first of all, when I was interested in UFOs, I did not start with Jung's Flying Saucers. I started with Above Top Secret, you know, a big tome of a collection of evidence. And then I read a book called Angels and Aliens. And of course, before any of that, I read Whitley Strieber, The Communion. Actually, so it was probably Strieber, then Above Top Secret, then Angels and Aliens, and then, you know, old beat up copies of Fate magazine, and, you know, it goes, you really can go in 100 different directions if once you start getting interested in flying saucers or UFOs.
Well, that was the way I went too, and although it might seem like there's a variety, I think that it's mostly cut from the same cloth, that material, I would say.
The nuts and bolts approach, you mean?
Even the non-nuts and bolts. I mean, I went from Strieber to Jacques Vallée and to John Keel, who I would still say are the best writers on the subject. Mm-hmm. And they're the non-nuts and bolts school. But even there, I would say that it's still informed by and informing the same basic narrative, which is because I read Communion, and then I spent maybe my 20s reading everything I could get my hands on about the UFO and alien abductions, and I was researching it, as I think many people do, as a phenomenon that was going on in the world out there, and maybe in my life too at some unconscious level, that I wanted to find out as much as possible about. So I was basically an information junkie.
Mm-hmm.
Now I would see that I was unwittingly a disinformation junkie.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly after about 10 years or whatever it was of reading, although my interest didn't dwindle, I found it harder and harder to find material that was actually bringing anything new to the table, and so I progressively lost interest in reading about UFOs. And so now I'm in the position where I haven't read anything from maybe the last 10 years and possibly more, but nor am I interested in reading it, because my sense is that we know everything we need to know about the UFO narrative without having to read any books at this point, because it's so completely suffused our culture.
Yeah, I think that's right. But if you first start being interested in flying saucers is not to think of it as a narrative at all, but to think of it as a phenomena, and you
right.
want to get the very best information you can
right.
on the phenomena, whatever it may be. But if you think of it as a narrative or as a myth, then you're right. You can watch Close Encounters and you're kind of done. Close Encounters and maybe Communion.
Well, that's a tough set. Limited to that, but of course we're exposed to the narrative and to the information stroke myth from a very early age, pre-rational probably, whether we're actually watching the movies or not, particularly later generations. So it's kind of by osmosis. And then in terms of actual sort of information-based narratives, well, yeah, you've got the Communion abduction hybrid narrative. You've got the Space Brother narrative. Maybe there's a few, several variations, but I would say that they're all, to a greater or a lesser degree, represented by popular culture, by fictional media at this stage.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that those representations and the, you know, the different kinds of stories that are on television or in movies have changed since they started in the 40s? Do you think that change in the narrative, the change in the way that we think of that narrative might be important?
Well, I think that they've superficially changed, like new elements have been introduced and old ones have been pushed out, and there's been variations on the theme, but I don't think that they've changed in any really fundamental way. I mean, you could say, okay, once the aliens were represented as pure nuts and bolts, physical, and then there was a development of sort of, and maybe this isn't linear, but like Invasion of the Body Snatchers was one of the earliest, and mm-hmm. and that is a nuance, that the aliens are spores from outer space that don't really seem to have any physical existence, or at least any, you know, humanoid or kind of autonomous existence, until they create a replica of human beings and take them over. So that's a very nuanced kind of view of the alien, and that was very early on. But nonetheless, what's consistent throughout all these narratives is that something is coming from the outside that is completely alien, and that is interacting with us and or taking us over, possessing us. In a way that's universal. There's this universal phenomenon that has this empirical reality independent of the subject, the psyche or the body or the individual that it's interacting with. So it's a totally non-psychological view of it. in that sense. Like that's one thing I'd say that hasn't been introduced to the narrative, unless I'm missing something.
So, did Jung think? But Jung didn't think it was completely non-psychological at all, right? I mean, he took the perspective that it was a psychological phenomenon, not saying that it wasn't physically manifest, but that it was interconnected to the psyche, and therefore it would have to have been a product of human consciousness.
Yes, although product is, I guess that was a difficult phrase, isn't it? Because human consciousness itself is hard to define, and then what do we mean by product? But anyway, generally speaking, yeah, he saw it as a psychological phenomenon.
Right. Well, what would be the difficulty with the word product? I'm not quite clear.
Because product is something that's produced, so then are we saying that, and this is what I'm getting to with my sort of explorations, are we saying that the UFO and the phenomena that's associated with it is being generated by humans, by the human psyche in some way? So then does that mean that it has no independent existence outside of the psyche? Yeah, that's what saying it's a product of the psyche suggests, doesn't it? Is that it doesn't exist without being produced by the psyche. And of course, that's...
Right. Well, I don't think that reduces it to the level of of hallucination, though, because if you say it has a physical... it's physically manifest and is a product, then you're saying some strange things about what the human psyche can do, maybe, but you're not saying that it doesn't have an independent existence.
No, I would agree with that, but I think that some people would counter that you're replacing one mysterious magical unknown with another, perhaps, and perhaps that's true.
I agree. You are. But I think that, I mean, I'm not, I don't know if I agree with Jung if he really believed that it was a physically actual object that, you know, you could go up and knock your hand against, that was also at the same time coming from the psyche. But I think I think that's what he said. I think that, I may not agree with what he said, but I think that was his hypothesis.
Well, he didn't have to, or he chose not to wrestle with what we're wrestling with now, because he wrote Flying Saucers when he believed that it was a psychic projection, therefore non-physical. Okay. And then later he admitted, okay, well, they do appear to be physical too, but more as far as I know, more as a footnote, like he had to admit that, so then... he would have had to revisit his thesis and talk about what we're talking about, but I don't think he ever did.
Right. So his original treatment would have been as some sort of hallucination, might not be the right word, but vision or product of the mind.
Except that he was acknowledging that others could see it, so it could be seen collectively. Like, it was a projection of the collective psyche.
Right.
So I guess you could say it's a fairly blurry line anyway between a light show and something that's actually physical, because light is physical in some shape or form, right?
Right. Well, it's a matter of interpreting things, maybe. You know, whether or not you see something identified and you interpret it as a flying saucer. So the way we're interpreting an unknown is a product of our collective consciousness or unconsciousness. Like you know, we all go out into the woods and on a camping trip, and there is something that flies over our campsite, and we all agree that we saw a flying saucer. Well, what we actually saw doesn't have all that much to do directly with... You have to work to figure out how what we say we saw and what we saw connect. You need to do... You need to really know, you know, on a scientific basis, you have to be repeatable and all sorts of, you know, they have to have a control and all that kind of thing. But so all we have there is a narrative, a socially accepted narrative about what happened. we don't.
Right. And this is a problem that I'm encountering, Doug, with this whole project, and I think anyone who gets into UFO does, which is that not only do you have to enter into the realms of psychology to try and sort of unpack the data, but you end up in the realms of philosophy also.
Right.
Because basically you're saying, what is real anyway?
Yeah, and that's what's the most exciting thing about what, for me, at the outset, when I was in my 20s and thinking about flying saucers, was ending up asking that kind of question. And once I did ask that kind of question, the first question of what is a flying saucer became a lot less interesting. Because, you know, now I don't even have to wait for a flying saucer to be perplexed by some weird miracle. All I have to do is look at my coffee cup.
Mm-hmm.
I sound like a Zen Buddhist or something, and I don't mean to, but I just, if you start to worry about reality and how you know what's real and what it means to be real and what's mental and all of that, you don't have to go very far. You just wake up in the morning and you'll have a problem. So,
sure, that's right. But on the other hand, you don't have to figure this out in order to take a sip of coffee, do you?
No, luckily.
Well, whereas if you want to try and write a book or get to grips with the UFO, then it's like you have to. If you want to take a sip of the UFO, so to speak, it's like you've got to figure out, is it physical, is it non-physical, is it extraterrestrial, is it fairy, is it human, is it this, is it that? It's this test, this acid test. And I think that it's an invitation, really, to the psychologist and the philosopher within all of us, and that the study of UFOs belongs in the realm of psychology and philosophy. I've got no doubt about that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
At this stage, but it's not. It's not. It's entering into the realm of religion because it's trying so hard to enter into the realm of science. Paradoxically, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. I definitely, first of all, agree with the what makes the UFO unique. The reason why you need it, kind of, in a way, is that it forces you to ask the question about what is real. It's the kind of object that begs you to ask that question, whereas a cup of coffee doesn't immediately.
Mm.
Because, and it, you know, it's not only that it's outside of your reach. I mean, airplanes are outside of your reach, but you kind of think you know what they are. But that it, there's, and you know, it's interesting too, because you wouldn't think, with the official narrative that they're craft from other planets, you wouldn't think it would necessarily lead you to question the foundation of reality. But, because, you know, the other planets fit into the story that we tell about reality, but somehow it does. And we've gone over how it gets you there before, but what is it? I mean, I guess a ghost might do the same thing too, or something that's just paranormal would do the same thing.
I think there's something about, like, with a cup of coffee and even an airplane, and I guess anything, really, I mean, potentially the UFO too, but we don't know. We can't talk about it in this way. But our bodies, bring it back to the bodies again, they know what it is. Just instinctively, like an animal knows, you know, the difference between an apple and an orange. And so, like, with a ghost, it may be that the body also knows what that is, and with a UFO or a flying saucer, likewise. I would say it's even likely that at some level we know what it is. So then I think, I mean, the obvious thing about them being from other planets is that there's a sort of assumption, I was trying to write about this today, there's an assumption that, I mean, because that's the most mundane explanation for UFOs, isn't it? Besides the fact that they're hallucinations or that they're government, you know, manipulation throughout history, which is kind of doesn't really add up unless you have some super advanced secret government that goes back to Atlantis. So let's say, outside of the fact that they're not real at all, the most mundane explanation is that they're extraterrestrials from another planet using advanced technology.
Right.
So if we go along with that hypothesis, we're still faced with a technology that we can't understand, and that, as Arthur C. Clarke famously pointed out, is indistinguishable to us from magic.
Mm-hmm.
So what I was trying to write about today is that because of that, we don't have the elements in our conscious mind, in our conscious experience, to interpret that technology. Even if we say it's from another planet and it's super technology, we still, that all that is like, I don't know, you probably know a proper philosophical term for that, but it's like a temporary sort of label we can stick on something to think that we've understood it.
I would say the philosophical term I would use would be Band-Aid. But go on.
But it doesn't help us understand it, does it? Because we don't know anything about other planets, and we don't know anything about this technology that is supposedly interacting with us. So basically, it's indistinguishable to us from magic. So the result of that, I think, is that we have to turn to dredge up the contents of our own conscious in order to understand it. So actually, the UFO, even if it's alien extraterrestrials from another planet, it is interacting with our unconscious, and therefore kind of getting dressed up in the contents of our unconscious, for the simple reason that we don't have the conscious experience to frame it.
When the conquistadors came to America, they were taken to be gods because of the horses they were on that had never been seen before.
Right.
Which means to me that they turned to their mythology to explain what at the moment was unexplainable.
Right. And in the alternate story, whether it's true or not, is that they, when they came in ships, that the natives couldn't even see the ships.
Right. Right. Because, it didn't fit in their way of seeing.
Yeah.
So that puts mythology and the unconscious pretty close together, and which is right in line with Jung, that the mythology, we know the mythology. It's not like it's unconscious and like we can't get conscious access to it, but it's unconscious in some other way.
Right. It's atavistic, isn't it? It's coming from a collective sort of storehouse of symbols that we're drawing upon unconsciously. And then, see, once they become conscious, we are not aware of the fact that they came out of this unconscious storehouse. So we take the myth for the reality, I think, is what happens.
Right. Well, I have a couple of thoughts that I'm not sure if I want to pursue them because they may distract me from the main point, but I'll just put this out. So language would work the same way, to kind of go to Lacan, who says that the unconscious is structured like a language. Language is collectively produced and shared. It's not something that if you think about it, you have conscious access to the words, but if you try to examine them consciously and critically, they fall apart. Like if you've ever tried repeating the same word over and over again, after a while you'll notice that it stops having a meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because in fact the sounds that you make and the meanings that you associate with those sounds aren't actually connected, and then you can get an independent kind of understanding of a word through just sheer repetition. So there's something about mythology and language that are the same, that there's something extra about mythology that isn't immediately apparent in its appearance. What I guess what I'm driving at by bringing that up, and I'm not, and again, when I originally brought it up, I wasn't sure if it was driving in anything, but the reason I bring that up is that it seems like the important part of what the UFO brings or forces upon a collective psyche, say, is mm-hmm. that it points to the gap, not the thing that connects a metaphor to what it's really literally describing, but the way a metaphor misses is what the UFO is pointing out, forcing you to realize. So that's why it sends you, you know, that's why you reach for myth or metaphor, is because it hasn't, because it doesn't actually immediately connect. There's this gap. It's imposed itself upon you and makes you realize this gap, maybe.
Well, that could fit with the idea that the UFO is symbolizing the psyche itself.
Right, and also what I was trying to drive at is connecting it to the problem of trauma, and the way that it's a literalization of the psyche's trauma, and of kind of a forcing of the trauma upon the psyche.
Can you say more about that?
Sure. Well, just so much is that if you have a collective consciousness that is full of gaps, things that don't connect, not even metaphorically, maybe, and the psyche is trying to come to understand this gap, it will create a metaphor or a symbol or something that will bridge the gap, and at the same time point to or have the meaning of the gap, and the flying saucer is that kind of image.
So it's like, is that similar to what I've been trying to demonstrate with Whitley Strieber's narrative and how it is full of holes, but the holes are, in a sense, the real story?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's why I wanted to kind of get to that, I think, was because I see that the flying saucer phenomena itself has this element of trauma, and as you say, a psychological component to it. And you know what we're dealing with Whitley Strieber is that just a variation of that same basic setup of a physical kind of literalization of the trauma of having a psyche, of having a consciousness and an unconsciousness.
All Hit Radio.
All right, you're listening to All Hit Radio, and it's 53 degrees at 13 minutes past the hour. And right now in our All Request line, I've got Mike Ledgerwood on the phone. Hey, babe, what would you like to hear? Hey, babe, I'm sorry, I can't hear you too well. You're going to have to speak a little closer into the phone. Okay, babe, what would you like to hear again?
We are observing your Earth.
Hey, Mike, I'm sorry, babe, but that's not on our playlist. And by the way, you sound great over the phone. Anyway, if you give us your request, we'll be glad to play it for you, babe. So let's hear it.
We are observing your Earth.
Listen, Mike, I'm sorry, babe, but we can't...
And we'd like to make...
I'm sorry, Mike, there's...
A contact with you.
In your mind, you have capacities, you know, to telepath messages through the vast unknown. Please close your eyes and concentrate with every thought you think upon the recitation we're about to say. Calling occupants of interplanetary craft. Calling occupants of interplanetary most extraordinary craft. Of interplanetary craft. Calling occupants of interplanetary craft. Calling occupants of interplanetary most extraordinary craft. You've been observing Earth
Well, I don't know if you heard an interview I did with Mike Klein a while back, but on that, in fact, the thing that got me the interview with him was I Facebook messaged him this idea. I don't know where it came from, possibly from my own unconscious, that the UFO as this sort of vesica piscis of light in the sky could be interpreted as the crack in the vagina as seen from the inside, from the womb, from the infant that's inside the womb being drawn out into light, into a new, a new realm of existence.
Yeah. And how did he take that?
Well, I don't remember, but I remember we spent quite some time talking about it. And I think, I mean, when you were talking now, it came to me because I was thinking, well, what's the trauma here? Okay, yes, there's a trauma in the past, and that is the birth trauma, and maybe that is being mirrored now in that the UFO is drawing us to, well, in simple terms, to an awakening, which is begins with the recognition of what you're describing, of the fact that we are living in a dream world, I guess, being drawn to see the ways in which our reality or our interpretation of reality doesn't add up. It's like when you're in a dream and it starts falling apart. That's because you're beginning to wake up.
Right. Right. And see, I find that kind of suggestion very compelling on the one hand and kind of dangerous on the other, because first of all, that's one of the things that I kind of, that's an idea that I came to in my 20s.
Yeah.
That absolutely. I was literally kind of in a dream of some kind. And you throw some psychedelics into the mix and that can be a pretty compelling story. Mm-hmm. But then what goes along with that is always, well, I'm about to enter actual reality and be whole. And that goes back to Jung's conception of the flying saucers as representing wholeness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a traumatic event in the sky that itself represents the promise of wholeness. And that's maybe what you start to reach out for when you feel that you're about to wake up or that reality is dissolving around you. And I guess I've, in the last 4 years, come to this idea that rather than trying to wake up, I should instead understand that that reality dissolving is actually always present. It's like it's the only way for reality to be, and that you're never going to arrive at a spot where you're really awake without being partially asleep. That you know that you've got this this is my old story. This is where I always go with this, but I ended up there naturally. I wasn't trying to push it there, but go ahead.
And does that become a position for you, or is it more of a simple acceptance that you don't really know if awakening will ever happen, so best to assume that it won't?
That's a good question. Can I remain open to the possibility that I could be whole?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. I guess I could. That would be a good thing to do. It seems like just my gut is telling me that's a good thing to do. But I would be concerned about that being open to the possibility of being whole, turning into a striving after.
Absolutely, I think that's it. It's like this balancing act, the razor's edge, that it's almost impossible for us to hold in consciousness, believe in whatever the idea of wholeness without striving for it. Therefore, the way, and with the metaphor of the baby, if the baby's trying to be born, and it's a bit of a hypothetical, I suppose that doesn't really happen. But if it's trying to bring about its birth by its own power, then that's only going to interfere with the natural birth process. I think, I mean, that's why it doesn't happen. Like, an infant doesn't have an awareness of, oh, I must go towards the light. If anything, it would be the opposite.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that I have come to recently is the idea that wholeness will mean a whole new set of problems, like another way of things going wrong, a more interesting way. That I'll try to be like accepting of that being, for me, wholeness and success are really bound up together. I have a, you know, I'm an American and the idea of being whole and being successful in my career, say, are really tightly wound up together. It's very hard for me to separate them out. I mean, I could go to a spiritual retreat and work on that, separating them out. But you know, then it seems like it becomes like, oh, I could be someone like me would just end up trying to make spiritual retreats into a career. So,
I know what you're talking about, but I think I'm seeing it from a different perspective.
Let me get to the finish line on this little thought, which is just that I have decided recently that success in my career will always take the form of new problems, new and better, and maybe even sometimes more stressful problems. So, for instance, recently, you know, I'm trying to go on a book tour, and I had, you know, pushback from my publisher, and there was debate about whether I would. They wanted to do the booking of the bookstores and not have me do it, and I felt a lot of stress about what was coming from my publisher. And then I had to realize that stress was actually what I'd always been seeking. That was the kind of success that when it came, I only could find it as a problem, you know. So that the same thing is with any kind of a effort to become whole, is that when you're no longer broken in the old way, you're going to be broken or have a problem in a new way.
Is that, are you sure that stress and that pressure only has to do with the nature of success itself and not to do with the kind of success what it is that you equate with success? As in, you know, that's the nature of the world. If you want to be successful in terms of having status and social standing, then that would increase stress. Whereas my sense of and my experience of becoming more whole is that stress is drastically reduced, not increased by that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You're probably right. On one level, but the other thing that happened though was when I accepted that, when I saw that these problems that I was dealing with were indications of some, you know, minor amount of success, my stress level went way down.
Right.
When I said to myself, these are the problems that I want, they stopped feeling quite so much like problems that were insurmountable. Because one thing about it was, I couldn't think of new problems that I wanted instead. In other words, like, oh, yeah, you're wanting to go on a book tour, so these are the problems that come along with it. The fact that you have these problems indicates that this is going to happen, which means that you're succeeding. So stop getting blowing them all out of proportion and stop getting so stressed about it because, you know, just answer or figure out what you're going to do with the problem instead of getting all torn up as if you're going to lose something, you know.
Well, I read recently, I think it was Julian Jaynes' Bicameral Mind thing. Uh-huh. Have you read that, by the way?
I haven't. I've heard of it. I know about it. One of the ideas from the Bicameral Mind is that at one point in our history, we actually heard directly from the social collective as a voice.
From the psyche, and that was the voice of the gods, and this is something I'm also working into my overriding thesis of the UFO as the psyche. But anyway, this wasn't why I brought it up, but he also mentioned that stress is correlated directly to decision-making. In other words, the more decisions we have to make, the more stress we experience. And that seemed right to me. It seemed like not an oversimplification, but a very simple way of understanding the nature of stress. I think that that's related somewhat to, because if we're if we're identifying success as some sort of outer accomplishment, and I mean, I'm trying to relate this to the UFO as well, because I think it is key, like, as long as we're seeing...
I have a question that comes out of what you just said, which is, if it's true that stress comes out of our decision-making, and that we can kind of also relate the stress that we feel to trauma in the psyche, or this feeling of not being whole...
Mm-hmm.
And I think then that what that means is that we're always concerned when we have to make a decision that we will lose a part of ourselves, that there's something unknown about it. Basically, that we don't know what the outcome is going to be.
It's unsafe, yeah.
So then the question becomes, what decision is the flying saucer representing? Or what decision does the arrival of the flying saucer indicate needs to be made?
Right. Well, I think it represents the ultimate decision, like in in Close Encounters, right? At the end, he makes the ultimate decision, which is to board the mothership, and the same Mission to Mars. If you saw that Brian De Palma movie, same story. He makes the ultimate decision, which is to leave everything behind and go off with the mothership.
Yeah. And, you know, Spielberg said that one of the things he regretted was that ending to that movie, as he became an older man and had a family and things.
Oh, really?
Yeah, isn't that funny?
That's funny.
But anyway.
Well, I mean, you could look at it two ways, and I think both would be valid. One is it's a dissociative fantasy, wanting to escape reality, and that's very obvious, that interpretation. And the other is perhaps equally obvious, that it's a transcendence of all... identification. So you're no longer identifying with your ego, with your attachments. You are letting the universe take you back into its bosom, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that's enlightenment, as I see it. Not that I do see it, but I mean, it fits with...
Yeah, no, as you intellectually see it, as you kind of piece it together, yeah. What's interesting to me about that is that if you take it to be transcendence, then you... then all the players have more of a part in the story, because it's not just Richard Dreyfuss's transcendence and his decision, but it's all these other players that have worked together to lead up to this moment where a few could transcend. So he's actually, at that moment, on the one hand, leaving the earth, leaving his responsibilities as a father and as a husband and as a... electrician behind. On the other hand, he's assuming a responsibility for the United States government, or a step further back from that, the Western culture, or a step further back than that, just humanity itself.
Yeah.
So it's a weird thing. He's dissociating on the one hand. On the other hand, if it is a dissociation, it's one that seems like it's built into the myth of Western culture, that, you know, this is something that we're aiming at.
Well, I think, isn't it a case of the surrogate having to very closely match the real thing as closely as possible, otherwise nobody would buy it.
Right.
So...
Yeah, okay.
And again, I think this is the danger of striving after awakening or enlightenment, is that striving is, well, this is what Prisoner of Infinity is about, those early chapters, isn't it? Is hooked into that infant dissociative mechanism, to the need to escape intolerable circumstances. So then, yes, I think to relax and enjoy life is the only way to move towards an awakening, and that entails accepting that this may be as good as it gets.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on one level, I completely agree with you, because, like I said recently, I became aware that the feelings I had of stress were born out of having arrived at a new set of problems, but the problems I wanted, and that what I had to accept then was that I would not have this moment when I arrived as a writer, say, where I was just confident and good. And, you know, maybe yeah. I have a moment of that, but that would not be the way I was. That it would always involve these other things, and maybe it would always involve some sort of some level of striving, too, and accepting that striving would be a part of what I was always on about, without expecting an arrival. So, you know, both. But all I'm doing is kind of flipping what you said, and it's in my typical way. It's like, oh yeah, you can. You have to accept the striving. It's like, oh no, you have to stop the striving and accept the reality. It's like, okay, but let's talk about Streberg more directly, because his case is, you know, particularly disturbing, and it's not so easy as what we've been talking about. In a way, it's not so nice.
Yeah.
Why is it, if we accept everything we've said up to now, that the UFO is all about a decision that we're collectively trying to make? Why is it then that a guy like Streber is selected to have such a horrible time for all of us?
Well, I think the answer's in the question, because I don't think it is a decision that we have to make or that we get to make. I think that that's the crucial fiction of the ego,
okay,
and of Streber and of all of us, that somehow, whether we're saved or damned, or whether we, you know, ride the evolutionary cusp or crest or whatever the phrase is, it's down to us. That I mean, we talked about that briefly with Castaneda, didn't we? The sort of stress. An obsession that can generate.
Right. Yeah. Trying to remember every detail of your life so that you can relive it again before you die and live forever. It's a pretty big task.
Yeah, and yet trying to understand the UFO may be equally absurd a task. If the UFO is, in some sense, represents the psyche, which is the totality of us as individuals and collectively, then it's like God. You can't understand it except by becoming it. And if you become it, well, there's nothing, there's no you there to understand it.
Right. Yeah. I can imagine that you could come to a new understanding of it, you know, like a scientist comes to a new understanding, where there's still a you there to understand it. It's just not the same you as you were before. And so then now you have, you know, as I say, a new set of problems, but you've got an understanding, a better understanding of the UFO than you did before, but you've also lost a bit of yourself, or you've gotten a new self in the process.
If there's a series of stages or phases in that, it could be that you just go from being, you know, a little Richard Dreyfuss to being a cosmonaut. Like, you go from having your own little Doug Lane problems to having God's problems.
Yeah, but okay, but let's stop right there. I love this metaphor, because let's go with Richard Dreyfuss into the mothership and imagine for a moment what he's going to experience next. Mm-hmm. I think finding a seat would probably be difficult.
What do I eat?
Yeah, exactly.
Do I still have to eat?
Yeah.
I didn't bring anything.
Right, exactly. He's going to have a whole slew of problems once he's on that ship. Now, some of them would probably be taken care of in advance. These are not schmucks that are flying down there. They know he's a human. But still, let's say they prepared something for him and he has a little spot. He still is going to be on an alien ship in a little container. It's going to be a stressful for him, a new kind of experience for him that is unlike any of the stresses that he's had before. It's not Absolutely. Going to present itself to him as a kind of just a nap on a waterbed. It's going to be, a bumpy ride.
Figuratively.
Yeah, well, probably figuratively.
Yeah. I guess it's kind of interesting in sort of just a mundane way, because there were two versions of Close Encounters, and of course the special edition, which I always thought was inferior to the original, in which and it's more or less replaced the original, in which you get to see the inside of the mothership.
Oh,
which,
yeah,
of course, is kind of a bust, particularly, you know, with the special effects that they had back then, although 2001 hasn't dated very much, but Close Encounters certainly has. And so, yeah, that transition was left unknown initially, and then Spielberg tried to represent it, and I would say failed. And I think it was a mistake to even try, because, I mean, within the realms of the metaphor, if we're seeing it as a metaphor, then he is metaphorically leaving everything behind. Well, he's literally leaving everything behind except his body, himself.
Right.
So that would include all of the stresses. So yes, he could bring his old self into this whole new realm and create a whole new series of problems, but it seems like if he did that, he would probably die of a heart attack, and or at the very least have a Whitley Strieber experience within the first few seconds, right?
Yeah.
Because it's this act of surrender that's being signified, isn't it? He's actually, and this is where I think the danger, quote-unquote, comes in, the dissociative aspect, he's really giving himself over to these higher beings and putting his life literally in their hands.
Okay, but how do you surrender to these higher beings without resistance? How do you know that you're surrendering?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's possible. I don't think you can surrender to anything outside of yourself without ending up with a rectal probe shoved up your butt, figuratively speaking.
Okay.
Because it's... whatever it is, as we keep going back to, if it's something outside of yourself that has physical form, then it's going to be as fallible as anything else once you get close up enough to see it.
Yeah. So if it's inside of yourself, what happens? If you're surrendering to something inside of yourself, how can that even be considered a surrender?
Well, I think it just ties into all the different things we're talking about, because from the little I've experienced of this kind of surrender, it isn't surrendering to something inside of oneself. That nonetheless is... It could be compared to, if not confused with, a higher authority or a deeper authority, in that whatever that is takes over one's life and makes all the decisions for one, and at that point one is just, you know, sitting on the beach with a martini, just enjoying the show. That's
right.
The potential for it.
Yeah.
Because one has relinquished that illusory need to direct one's own life and to shape it and turn it into something perfect and streamlined. And
can you get a martini with that? Well, that seems to me like basically becoming... I mean, at that point, you become the authority. If you've completely surrendered, then you become the authority that you're obeying. And once you become that authority, then are you an authority that has no outside at that point? There's nothing... I mean, you're aligned with the biggest, toughest guy
you
in the block.
The head honcho, enchilada, the big cheese.
Right. So at that point... It's your way or the highway, really.
For you.
For you and for everything else. There's nothing outside of you.
There's nothing outside of you. Well, there'd still be a universe, wouldn't there, outside of you?
I guess. Not if you've surrendered to it inside yourself completely. Because then you would be completely enmeshed in it. So the universe and you... Your will would be the universe's will, and the universe's will would be your will, and therefore... You know, well, I think of the Beyond, if you haven't read the stupid comic book, but there's this character called the Beyonder that was a universe to himself, which we've talked about before, right? So whatever he thought of would be.
it's kind of the promise of Scientology too, isn't it? If you become an operating Seton or whatever the next level is, you get your own planet to lord it over.
Right, right. The problem is power. I mean, the what we run, because, and I wrote a little essay about what you read about Charlie X, as he was overwhelmed by his own power. He couldn't, anything he thought would happen, and he completely lost control of himself in the process
right.
of that.
Star Trek, yeah.
Yeah. So that's yeah, right. That's a Star Trek reference. I'll nerd it up with anybody. But yeah, so it seems like power itself has this weird dilemma in it, you know. Because even if you think, if you try to imagine, maybe it's just our perspective. But if you try to imagine perfect power, it starts to be too much and go wrong. It's kind of a nightmare vision. To think of yourself perfectly aligned with the universe.
I think this is where the surrender comes in, because I think that the only way to not be corrupted by power, or absolutely corrupted by absolute power, is to have become completely accepting of being totally powerless.
Right.
And so that... brings us back to the trauma again, like the original trauma and the original experience for all of us is being completely powerless.
Right, but that powerlessness only arrives when the outside arrives.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So if you're going to get free of, if you're going to allow the line between subject and object to dissolve, you have to first return to that state of complete powerlessness, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what I'm thinking right now is that, you know, as I read your book, it at times was easy to think that Whitley Strieber was, you know, making mistakes that he could have avoided, or that his problems were in some way or another unique to him. But talking to you about it, it seems like you can easily take his problems and see them as basically, you know, universal problems, and that you know, the flying saucer represents the same problem. You can start to see the same problem, you know, anywhere you look.
Yes. I wouldn't... I mean, I'm glad that you see that. I'm a bit concerned it took 10 chapters or whatever it's been to see it, but that I wouldn't consider it worth, like, investigating his case if I didn't think it was unique enough to be universal, if you recognize that paradox.
Yeah, I do, I think. I think the one thing I would say is that because of the darkness of what Strieber went through, I always... It's Strieber, right?
It is Strieber, but for some reason it's like either or, you know, both.
So it's Strieber. Well, Strieber's the darkness of his story and your peculiar relationship with him, or your unique, not peculiar like odd, but individual relationship with him, and maybe peculiar too.
Well, it's one-sided though, so it doesn't quite constitute a relationship, I don't think, unless you want to posit a psychic one or an energetic thought.
Okay. But, well, your encounters with him and your particular take on him, then. It seems to me that there's always a tinge, and this is, you don't have to use this or not, I'm just telling you, you know, kind of as an editor-critic type, that there's this tinge of putting a little bit of blame on him, on Strieber, and not... And suggesting, while that the experience is universal, that there was a solution that he's missing, and I just don't know if there is. I just can't see. I mean, there's maybe a different way to go about it, but it's not exactly a solution. The problem stays there, you know, however you go about trying to fix it.
Well, the problem is unconsciousness,
right.
And that's all of our problems. And I certainly want to avoid what you're talking about, but obviously apparently I haven't.
Yeah.
But I think it is very tricky to point out what somebody is unconscious of
right,
without making it look like it's a problem or it's their fault or that, you know, they could be seeing it but they're not, kind of thing.
Right.
What that I would, is very tricky.
And yeah, the only thing I would suggest that you might consider doing is including a bit more the ways in which what we discussed today and the way in which the puzzle of what actually happened to him remains a puzzle for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that we're not expecting that you're, you know, every time you point out what he doesn't see, that you've got the X that marks the spot of what actually happened. You know, all you can, because you don't, you're never, neither of us are going to know what actually happened to him. But, and he certainly doesn't know. But what you're really pointing to is the impossibility of that X, I think.
I think so, and or at least the danger of jumping to conclusions and of trying to insist that we do know when we don't.
Right.
So that quote I posted at your blog today, it wasn't a quote because I couldn't find it, but that ignorance is not the problem, but assumption of knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and okay, and so maybe we could talk a little bit about that hipster blog post I wrote for Right Where You're Sitting Now.
Sure.
Yeah. I read that, and I agree that the assumption of knowledge is the problem, not ignorance. And yet, that even the weird thing is you can't help but assume knowledge. So maybe I was wrong to criticize you just a moment ago, because you can't help but suggest that there's that you know the X. It's like there's always, and even to talk about the X, you have to put it in terms as if it's knowable.
Right, I know. I don't know what to do about that. I mean, like, I've been addressing this more and more directly with what I've been writing since Prisoner of Infinity. That's part of it, more generally about UFO and psychology. And one of the criticisms I make is that you can't approach an unknown with the assumption that it is part of the known.
Right.
But the person I was corresponding with, Peter Lavenda, in fact, the writer, said that, well, that's the scientific approach. And I guess that's true. Like, how do we approach it at all? I mean, even if we're approaching it, there's an element of assumption there, because if we just accepted that it maybe wasn't part of the known and never could be, we would stay away from it, I think.
Well, on the other hand, it marks a limit for the known. And it's always, we always are kind of wanting to push past limits.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I don't know why exactly. I mean, I guess I do know why, because it seems like that desire to push past limits is what allows us to know anything. There's always, because one of the things we're talking about with language is that we're always positing something that isn't really what we're talking about, just to speak, just to be able to communicate. We're always having to posit something that, as if we know it when we don't, going back to the coffee cup, you know. Luckily enough, it works. I can drink my coffee. There are times when it doesn't work, and that's when you start to go, you're presented with a problem that compels you.
We are your friends. Calling occupants of interplanetary. Observing your earth, and one night we'll make.
and transmit thought energy far beyond the norm. You close your eyes, you concentrate, together that's the way to send a message we